This is an interview with John Martin, who served as a wireless operator in the RAF during the Second World War. Now, John, would you like to tell us where you were born and where you were brought up?
Yes, I was born in the outskirts of London, the borough of Willesden, and lived about 5 miles from Marble Arch, I should think. And very poor days for a lot of people. I hadn't really got over World War One before they started on World War Two. but I enjoyed my childhood, I suppose, there. But I think somehow my father didn't help me along very well. He didn't encourage anything like secondary education, and he wouldn't agree to me going to the grammar school, although I passed the first test for it, and I was due to go up for an interview, but no, he didn't want anything of that. His idea was that your education begins when you leave school. A man with very fixed ideas, you couldn't persuade him, or I don't know if I wanted to, really, because the like I say, we were very poor, like most other people, and if you go to the grammar school, you're expected to be well equipped with sports equipment and books, and you're expected to go on school outings and that, which is costly. So probably he did, it was the right thing he said, and in fact is I couldn't afford to go. So I forgive him for that.
Oh dear.
But as far as the RAF was concerned, first they wanted people who had been to grammar schools and had secondary education, because I suppose it would be so much easier for them to train those people. Mm. But in the end, they had to give up a bit and take people on their face value rather than what sort of education they'd had.
Yes, indeed. It was the sheer volume of numbers of aircrew that were needed.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you were brought up, though, as you say, in sort of Willesden, and do you remember the early years of the war before you joined the RAF?
Oh yes, most certainly, yes. I mean, it seemed that as youth, I thought it was a long time starting, nothing happened. And I was looking for this, that and the other to go on, you know. But then, of course, the first real action that we saw was the Battle of Britain, the air war. And that's not really exciting, and but we didn't, in the actual battle, we didn't suffer much bombing at all.
But did you see sort of dogfights overhead?
Oh yes, plenty of dogfights, yes. And, we saw the, I tell you what, I did witness one Saturday afternoon, it was a Focke-Wulf 109, come over and shooting down the barrage balloons.
Yes.
There was absolutely no opposition to him at all. He just enjoyed himself going round, machine gunning them. Of course, they only wanted probably one bullet in them, and that was it. And they caught fire and went down.
Gosh.
And I can remember that bit, but I suppose it sounds a bit wicked to say this, but as a youth, you're waiting for the action to start, and it seemed such a long time before anything got going. But when it did, of course, it was a bit too much. That was the blitz on London, which started with the major raids on the dock areas of London. But from where we were, we could see a lot of it quite clearly, and the sky was red from the fires that had set up. And then, from then on, they spread out a bit to bomb all London, and it got quite hairy at one time. living with us. Because of the war, she come to live, and she had a room upstairs, but was always moaning about her poor legs, how bad her legs were. She couldn't walk. And I used to listen with hardly any sympathy at all to her motherboard. But anyway, when we had this bomb drop just across the road, my parents used to go into the shelters which were built on the road. But I, as a youth, I couldn't be bothered with that, and I stopped in my own bed. But this, of course, this loud explosion woke me up, and I realised that we suffered quite a lot of damage to the house. And I thought, oh, Grandma's is still upstairs. I thought, oh, I better go and help her down. Before I knew where I was, Grandma, with the poor legs, if you could argue, came by me like a greyhound, nearly knocking me over. And she went out through the front door. She was in the shelter long before I was. But it all finds a bit of a funny bit that sticks in my mind. Yes. About Grandma's poor legs. Anyway, yes, it was quite sad, and a little bit further up the road there was a sad case of a newly married couple, and they'd been in the shelter in the street almost all the time the rape was going on, and there was a bit of a lull in the bombing. They thought the couple were newly married, and they thought they were going to make a cup of tea and bring some out for their parents. And they just went into the house, and they suffered a direct hit, and they were both killed outright. And another incident a bit further down the road in the corner shop, and that was hit by, got a direct hit. And the casualty was the man of the shop, the owner of the shop, and he was badly injured. And the rescue party went in and dug him out, and they got him into the ambulance. And just as the ambulance was driving away, there was another, almost a direct hit on the ambulance, and killed all the crew, and this man as well, who had just got out of the bomb building.
Oh dear.
Yeah, so I think his number must have been up, and
yes.
And that was it.
Yes. And did you, I mean, because you were at that stage, you were almost old enough to join the Home Guard?
No, they wouldn't have us in the Home Guard. Volunteered, but no, they didn't want us. I think they got such a response from their recruiting drive that they picked and choose them. They wanted people, probably a bit of World War One experience, and also I suppose they were wise enough to think that we'd be gone anyway, us younger ones. So no, I never got in the Home Guard. They didn't know what they were missing.
No. So what, you were working by that stage?
Sorry?
Were you at work by that stage?
Oh, I was working, yes. Started work at 14 years of age. In fact, I left school at about 3 o'clock on the Friday afternoon, and I was at work at 8 o'clock the following Monday. And there was no break. I went straight from one thing to the other because, like I say, money was scarce, and also, of course, jobs were scarce, so if you got the chance for a job, you went and took it.
So what did you do?
That was coach building, and we also used to repair private cars, but mainly they were doing, putting the bodies on commercial vehicles. I remember was, I look back on it, I didn't think so then, of course. I thought it was just a grumpy old lot, but it must have been a hard life for the proprietors of the business, drumming up enough business.
Yes.
Keep going.
Yes.
Because my funding was scarce all round.
Yes.
I could always remember that the people who were employed there, the men, of different trades like blacksmiths and body makers, what they call them, they did the body work. But on a Friday afternoon, there was always a dread that the boss would come round and say, "That's it then, pack up your tools." And they got an hour's notice that their job had ended, and that was it.
It's a very hard life.
Oh, it was a hard life. Was a hard life.
Mm.
And remember, of course, they nearly all had families to keep going.
Mm.
And it was vital that what they called the dole money was so pitiful. It was probably last for about one day's living, I should think, out of seven.
Mm.
But it was really, really hard days for a lot of people.
Mm. Yes, and very, very dangerous days as the Blitz became apparent. Yes. Okay. So, at what point then did you volunteer for the RAF?
Well, I used to watch these. They used to advertise in the daily papers for air crews, but there was always this bit at the end which said, "Okay, what is you've got to have a secondary education." Then I noticed that after Don, that was missed out, so I got off and volunteered. Now, in the meantime, I really wanted to go into air crew, but I went and volunteered for an armourer, to be an armourer in the RAF. You know what they did? They loaded up the guns and loaded the bombs and that sort of thing. I thought that sounded a very interesting job, as I couldn't get into air crew. So I went to the recruiting office, and yes, I was quite suitable, and passed one or two little exams and the medical, and Then suddenly somebody burst in and said, "I'm sorry, we can't have you. You're in a reserved occupation. Your boss has been on the phone." And that stopped that. I thought I was trapped then in the bodybuilding, and I was going to miss all the action throughout the war. But perhaps it would have been better if I didn't have it done.
Yes.
But then eventually I volunteered then. I noticed that the advertisements they had dropped off this bit about secondary education, so I volunteered for air crew. And that was accepted, and I passed the necessary medical and a bit of an exam. And then I was called up to go before the Air Crew Selection Board. That was it. up in Bedfordshire, near Bedford.
Mm-hmm.
And I was dreading this, and I didn't do very well at the written work, I remember, because it was set for people who had been to grammar school. But I went before the actual selection board, the panel, and that was very frightening. I think there were three or four group captains sat there in a row, and there you were in the front of them, on a chair, and they were all asking questions, and they got me doing little exercises in logarithms and all that in front of them, you know, they were all looking at you. And I thought, "Oh, I failed this, you know, no good, they're going to choke me out." And then after them, they said, "Right, well, that's we think that you'll make a very good pilot." Of course, I was delighted with this, and I thought, "Well, fancy picking me as a pilot, you know, training for a pilot." And it all went well, and I started on the pilot training, and then we were sitting in class one afternoon, and some bloke came in, I think it was a squadron leader, and he said, "I've got something to say to you." He said, "The whole entry, you're going to be bomb aimers, not pilots, because there's a great shortage of bomb aimers.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of grumbling and grizzling and all that, and no, that was it. He said that, I don't know where I got the courage, but I stood up and said, look here, sir, I volunteered as a wireless operator. You know, I was told by the selection board I would make a good pilot. And here you are, telling me we've got to be bomb aimers. Can't I go back to being a wireless operator, my original ambition? Oh, I don't think so, he said. I'll look into it and I'll let you know. Anyway, a couple of hours went by and he came back to the classroom and said, yes, that's all right then. If you want to continue as a wireless operator, that will be all right. You'll be posted within a few days to get on with that course. So that's how I came back to being a wireless operator.
Yes, and it was good that you stood up and spoke for yourself.
Yes, I don't know how I got the courage. must have been that bit in me that been a rebel or something. But there were a lot of people, you know, the whole course, some of them had very good educations. And although you're educationally on the same category, pilots, navigators and bomb aimers, but of course they'd all set, they'd all been told they would be accepted for training as pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And they suddenly get that thrown at them.
That's right. So where did you go?
Well, I went then up to Blackpool,
ah,
where you start the initial wireless training. And believe it or not, we were upstairs at some classrooms above Woolworths. No, Burton's. Burton's the Dailers, that's it,
mm-hmm,
in Blackpool, upstairs above their shop. They start off, you know, in very elementary things, move on. And you get up to a certain stage when you can read more very slowly. And then you're posted off to a signal school where it's much more comprehensive. And not only do you do the Morse training and all that, but you do maintenance of wireless equipment, and much more general, wider training.
Mm-hmm.
Than you thought you might have to do. And then in those days, when you'd done this initial full-time course, I think it was 4 months training, that was, you were sent out then to the stations to get some experience as a ground wireless operator.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent off to a squadron, and they were actually an army cooperation squadron.
Where was that?
That was down in the New Forest.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the name of the place now, but it was literally on the edge of the New Forest.
Mm-hmm.
So Stony Cross, that was the name of the station, yes.
Right.
And it was a huge place, and you could see, although there was very little going on then, you could see the idea of it was, because I know that the D-Day activity went off from there.
Mm.
Anyway, when I got on this station, being a fighter station, I realised there wasn't a Morse key on the plates. And yet I'd been sent there to get experience as a wireless operator. But I really enjoyed it, because the CO was a very down-to-earth man, and he said what he wanted to say, he didn't wrap it up, he didn't abide by RAF regulations very much. What he thought, he said, and that was it. Now, he was a very, very fine leader of men, but he knew practically everybody by their Christian name,
mm-hmm,
and if you went along with what he said, you had a pretty good life. And he would listen, he arranged all sorts of things, like there was still contractors working there, civilian contractors, and he arranged with them that when they pick morning, coming back to start the week's work, they would also bring us back from Southampton Station. So that meant to say that if we went on a weekend leave, which was about every month, you didn't have to come back on the Sunday night, you could come back Monday morning and come in with these contractors. And that's the sort of man he was.
What was his name?
Sorry, his name?
Yeah. You remember that?
That, can't remember that. I remember the wing commander.
Oh.
Well, that was another thing. When I first arrived there, I was met by this flight sergeant. Of course, in the signal school, the flight sergeant is something to be really wary of and demands the greatest respect. But this flight sergeant, he said, just go to the desert off a tea from the Nassau, do you want some? And I thought, what? That was the flight sergeant said that to me, an AC2, you know. But that's the sort of station it was, mm-hmm. all round.
Very nice.
And, I remember another thing about this this CO over there. These fighter planes were fitted with the what they call IFF sets, identification friendly foe, and they were all fitted with a means of blowing them up if the aircraft was crash landed. One of the things you're supposed to do is to blow up the IRA set,
mm-hmm.
so that it didn't fall into enemy hands. And what that did, it continually sent a signal so that our radar could identify that you were an Allied aircraft. But as I say, the mechanism that set off an explosion inside the set was just one single button. It didn't have a cover over it or anything. And it was easy as easy to set it off accidentally. And what you do, you create this explosion inside the aircraft, which obviously didn't do the aircraft much good. Apart from destroying the IFS set itself. Anyway, the mechanics were working on this aircraft, and one of them accidentally set off the IFF explosion by pressing this button. And it's really a court-martial offence if you do that. If he went over there and he was swearing and cursing everybody around it. Right, he said, get that lock cleared out. He said, dig a hole and bury that wreckage. And I'll see what I can do about it. And I was on the phone in his office at the time when he was making telephone calls, because he never kept you out of his office. He said, he'd say, come in, sit down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to somebody he knew on another squadron. And he said to him, have you still got that spare IFF set there? And he must have said yes. Right, he said, I'm coming over to fetch it. And he went over to this other station, scrounged this IFF set, had it fitted into the aircraft, and nobody above him knew anything about it.
Wow.
He protected his men, you know. He was a wonderful, wonderful commander.
Yes.
But he wasn't lax or
mm-hmm.
anything like that. He did his job wonderfully well. And everybody admired him and would do anything for him. So anything he wanted doing, they'd make sure it was done. So I really enjoyed that short stay with that squadron. Now, come then, he called me into his office once and said, your posting's gone through, carry on with your aircrew training.
Mm-hmm.
He said, now look, he said, Bomber Command, he said, just his words, he said, that's a bloody dangerous place to be. He said, I can get you off if you like, you can stop here with me. I've only got to make a phone call. And I thought, no, I said, I'd rather continue with the course, you know. He said, well, that's all right, if that's what you want. best of luck. Hope you get through it all right. That was the sort of man, you know, he was all the time. So off I went then to the second course of the wireless operating, to take up the air operating side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you start off by flying in the, what they called the Domedy, and that was the RAF name for the Havilland airliner, two-engine airliner.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fitted out to carry 5-7 pupils, I think. And you took it, and an instructor, and you took it in turns to sit at the set and do two or three exercises on it, and then you were back in the passenger seat. Well, another chap came and sat at the set and did each the exercise. And that was the first time you ever flying, ever did any flying whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And, but unfortunately, I was picked to be the first one on the set, so I didn't really witness the takeoff. And the first thing I did, looking out the window after adjusting the set and getting everything ready there, looked out the window to find myself, we were probably at about 1,000 feet then, and I wondered where I was going to be so high above the ground. But that's how you started off. They were so slow, these aircraft, that you get over, we're not far from Bristol, and we used to fly over Bristol, go up to 10,000 feet was the absolute maximum ceiling of these aircraft. And to do what we call direction finding on the direction finding loop. I don't know if you ever noticed it on the top of the wartime aircraft, the RAF, they've got this loop. Sometimes it's concealed in a sort of a streamlined covering.
Yes.
But what it is a rotating aerial where you can detect, whereby you can detect the direction that the signal was coming from. That was all part of the early training. But like I say, after being on the set so long, somebody else would come and take over and away you go. But and when you've done a certain amount of training and you're proficient in that bit, you go off solo in a little aircraft which was called the Percival Proctor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was they were lovely aircraft, and most of them were still fitted out in a civilian trim inside, and they were trimmed out just like a posh private car, so it was quite luxurious. But the front seat next to the pilot was taken out, and the radio equipment was there, and I, as the trainee wireless operator, used to sit on the back seat then to operate the set. One snag was that the pilots, a lot of them, were fighter pilots, and they were on rest from squadrons, and they used to fly these little propters like mad things. And they used to, on the aircraft, on these little ones, used to fly out, trail out 50 feet of trailing aerial to get low frequency signals. And they used to fly that low over the River Wye that they dipped the aerial into the water. That, of course, shorted out any signals you might be getting. They didn't care about the fact that you were trying to get on with your training. All they did was wanted to do what they wanted to do.
Yes.
Now, it's no good complaining, because the next time you went up, you get it even worse. But there were some very good, very gentlemanly pilots there as well. But I remember the first time, about the only pilots I saw from the Royal Indian Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
They were perfect gentlemen, they were. And when you came down each time, they'd say, did I do right for you? And did you have any problems? Did it go well? And yes, thank you very much, you know, but they were actually be interested in the training. Yes, yeah, so that was very interesting because it's the first time you really start proper flying and you are the only wireless operator in the aircraft. You know. So you, you feel that you're quite competent while you're doing it. And you finish that course, but of course you're not. You're only just really just starting. And then you go off from there, you go to what they call the advanced flying unit, which was when I came to Wales for the first time in 1943. So I've been in Wales, came to Wales a long time before I was a Welshman, didn't I?
and so that was at Stormy Down, was it?
Yeah.
Right.
No, not Stormy Down. No, no. That was a gun that came a bit later. And, no, beg your pardon, yes. No, I did go to Stormy Down first, that's it. And you're supposed to do an air gunnery course there, but they didn't seem to have much time. We didn't get any time to do any air firing. We did a bit of ground firing, and off then we went because we were needed to take up the course at the advanced flying unit up in North Wales. So, yes, that was the first time I came to Wales, Stormy Down, yeah. And up in North Wales at the advanced flying unit, they were also training navigators at the same time in Avro Anson's.
Yes.
And we were doing, we had a, what we call a screen to start with, at somebody, an experienced wireless operator, to be with you, but you were the wireless operator of the aircraft that's doing an actual job of work. And after a couple of weeks, you're on your own. You fly solo as the only wireless operator there. You're the only person in touch with the base. So you begin to feel quite important then. But they were wonderful things to fly in. And we used to do more or less the same route every time when we take off from there, go over, not quite over the Isle of Anglesey, but just to the side of it, and up into the Irish Sea, all over the Scottish islands, and some of them are really tiny. And the map reading that you have to do is it couldn't be easier because you could pick out these little islands and know to a square foot where you were. And then you would turn inland, and but it's for the navigator's benefit. And they go over, and he's giving the pilot his directions, and you fly eastwards over the Scottish mainland and the Highlands, and then you return and do the same route back again. And it's the most wonderful flying I've ever done, or ever liked to do, I should think. Really enjoyable. So that's that bit then, and of course you're beginning to feel quite experienced by then, and you're shipped off to operational training unit, which we started off doing in Rutland.
In where, sorry?
Sorry?
Where did you do your...
The county of Rutland.
Oh, Rutland. Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the station. Oh, it'll come to me then. But this is when you start, the first time you will fly an operational aircraft, and you do quite a long training in this operational training unit, and you finish up with doing a sort of a half operation. And depending on what's doing, some of them went off on dropping leaflets over France. And we were pushed off nearly up the coast of Norway on an air sea rescue search. So an aircraft went down into the sea, and they thought there was a good chance that the crew had got into a dinghy. And three of us, three Wellingtons, were sent off to look, search this sea area which we were given to see if we could see anything of it, but no, it was, we didn't see anything, and it was murky.
Yes.
You realise, trying to keep looking at the sea, it's very difficult. Your eyes go blurred, and you have to look away for a few seconds before you can come back and concentrate. But however, it was quite a long trip, and something about 8 hours, I think, we were away.
It was RAF Cottesmore, was that perhaps?
Cottesmore, that was the place,
right,
yes.
Okay, yeah.
But then, while we were at Cottesmore, we got shifted because the Americans took over Cottesmore. They'd be airborne forces, I think, the American airborne forces.
Uh-huh.
And we were sent off to... the Northamptonshire Leicestershire border, a place called Husband Bosworth.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the operational training was split into two halves. You did the one half, what they called it, the satellite station, and the second half, which is more advanced, at the main station. Only about 6 or 7 miles away, but you had to change stations. But you really started doing long trips then.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first part of that thing was where I met my wife. She lived in the village, but she was already in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, and I met her because she came home on leave. We met at the local dance, and here we are, 70, nearly 76 years later, still together.
Wonderful.
And I remember a funny thing happened there, that dropping bombs there, a little practice bomb, that's about 12 pounds, I think, in weight, something like that. And you went on a range, and they were plotted, and they gave you a wind speed, and this was not actually the wind speed and direction which was blowing there. And the idea was you couldn't cheat, the bomb aimer couldn't cheat, because you could very nearly see where you got to drop the bombs. But if you used the wind speed that you were given, the bombs perhaps wouldn't even drop on the target, but they'd drop somewhere nearby. And we went off there doing one exercise, and I think we dropped 12 bombs there. And we came back, and the bombing leader said, "Yes," he said, "you did very well." He said, "but one of your bombs we can't trace. We don't know where it fell." "Oh, nothing about that. No. How did that come about?" Anyway, funny thing was that I was in the local pub near the airfield there, and there was some old bloke in there raving on about this bomb being dropped, and blew a bit of his head away of his back garden. And of course, that's obviously our bomb that dropped on him.
Did you own up to it?
I didn't let on anything, of course. About it being our bomb, just kept quiet. Turned my collar up a bit, you know. Get out of the way. Yes, that was quite a funny thing, that, wasn't it?
Yes, yes,
indeed.
Got
this bomb and then have a complaint.
Yeah.
Meet the complaint and who's on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, by the time you finish operational training unit, in the old days, of course, you go straight off to a squadron then, but later on in the war, they knew better, were sent off to what they called Lancaster Finishing School.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn to find Lancasters, because mm-hmm. believe it or not, the poor old squadron commanders had in the old days, in the early days of the war, not only did they have all the operations to do, but they had to train the incoming pilots to fly the aircraft that they were using on the squadron. bit much, wasn't it? But that sorted out, and I say we were sent to this what they call Lancaster Finishing School to sort of five long training exercises from there before you go off to the squadron.
Yes.
And
So where was the
first operation is done by the pilot alone. He goes off on what they call a second dickey. It's taken on by a very experienced crew, and fly with them to get an idea what it's about. But that didn't happen to us. We went straight off, pilot as well, on the first operation. Nobody knows what to expect or anything, But like I say, we didn't last long. We did two operations, got shot up each time with flak, and the next time, the third time, nearly at the target, we fell foul of a night fighter. That's when we came down.
So, in terms of your first two operations, what were your targets?
Always Berlin.
It was Berlin. So you did three operations.
That's
right. All Berlin. On Berlin, and on the third one, a night fighter got you.
And on the squadron, they were absolutely fed up to go to Berlin. It was during the time called the Battle of Berlin.
Yes.
And I forget how many raids they did on it. Nearly about 30 consecutive nights, I think.
Wow.
Really.
Wow.
And they were all fed up to death with it.
Wow.
They were all fed up to death with keep going to Berlin, you know.
Yes.
And the station commander there, the group captain, was a really officious old bloke, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when we met him, he said what we couldn't do and what we couldn't do and all that. Anyway, he always attended the briefings. And when the target map was exposed from under the sheet, everybody in the room shouted, "Wow, bloody hell, we're not going there again, are we? Go, no, you know." And I thought, well, this group captain has something to say, but no, he knew better than that, he kept quiet. He's official to them, what's gone then. The experienced crews there, people have been to Berlin several times.
Yes.
They were really shocked to be going there again.
Yes.
And of course, it really was a hot target.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And we didn't get back. But,
no. I mean,
if you want to hear, I'll tell you a bit about how we got shot down.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Right, well, we were just really coming up to the target. We wasn't far off. And suddenly, I better tell you a little bit about what the wireless operator did.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you a bit about what the wireless operator
did.
Of course, he was his job to keep in touch every half an hour with the base. Not the base, no, the group.
Mm-hmm.
Not the squadron, the group. And they would send things like weather forecasts and what had been found at the wind speeds by the aircraft in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you had to get all these and pass them on to the navigator. But while this was only every half an hour, and in the meantime, you used to do a job, I'm trying to think what they called it, was to listen out for enemy ground-to-air talk.
Mm-hmm.
And jam it with your transmitter.
Right. So how would you transmit? How would you jam it?
Sorry?
How would you jam the signals?
But with this case, we had put the pick up enemy fighters talking to their base or vice versa, and switch over to the microphone and swamp the frequency with the noise of this engine, which of course would blot out anything they could we were talking about. That was our job during that time. But also, the squadron itself, this was just the squadron thing, was they said that you could carry out this this business while you were under the astrodome, look backwards now and again to see you're keeping on frequency. And you could be looking out the astrodome helping the gunners. This was accepted on the squadron as a thing to do. And that's what I was doing, was actually looking out the astrodome, reaching backwards to cover this frequency I was given and breathing, but jamming the German air to ground transmissions. And I suddenly looked round at the clock. Oh, time to get to the group broadcast, which was most important when they sent anything I wanted to hear. So I dived back to retune the set. But before I could do that, there was cannon shells ripping past my right arm. If I'd have remained standing under the astrodome, I would have been right in the path of them. And they'd be ripping by, and they were sending blue flashing lights all over the room. And I think perhaps the navigator who sits just in front of me, but a bit further out than me, I think he was hit by them. But I couldn't be sure because I never had time to check up on that. But anyway, I knew we had been badly hit. I switched over to the intercom. And of course you realise you can't have that on all the time, else the rest of the crew would hear what was going on my wireless set, rather than what they wanted to hear talking to each other. So you kept off the intercom for most of the time. And I switched back on to just in time to hear the skipper saying, "Bail out, bail out." And the navigator and I, he couldn't, if he was hit by these shells, he couldn't have been very badly hurt because he, at the same, we stowed our parachutes side by side, and we were both getting on at the same time. So you realise the pack, the actual parachute pack, we didn't wear that in the aircraft. We only wore the harness that staked it. We put the pack on only when and if necessary. But anyway, the order of bailing out was that I would go out of the back door of the cockpit, into the fuselage, down the fuselage, jump out of the back door with the mid-upper gunner. After the mid-upper gunner, rear gunner would rotate his turret and drop out from the back of the aircraft. He wouldn't come back in the aircraft at all. He would bail out from his turret. Anyway, at the back of the cockpit, there's a door. And as I opened this door, the flames and the heat came at me. The whole of the fuselage was blazing away like Marion. And I knew all I could do was slam this door, and there's no good time to go through there, because I wouldn't have got very far. But in that split second that I had the door open, I could see the mid-upper gunner climb out of his turret. But the thing was, it was completely wrecked, his turret. It must have been badly hit by cannon shells. And it was leaning over to one side. But believe it or not, there was the mid-upper gunner climbing out of it. He got his shoes on, so I knew that he was very likely to get out of the aircraft. But anyway, I knew it was no good me trying to get through these flames, so I went back into the cockpit and I could see that nobody had got out. And I think I know now what happened, that the escape hatch is in the nose of the aircraft, and the seeing as it was going up to the target, the bomber would be laying there prone in front of that, and right over the escape hatch. And I think what happened, that he was either very badly wounded or perhaps killed. And because of that, because he was lying over the escape hatch, nobody else could get out. If you could imagine a motor car, you know, trying to get out down where your foot pedals were, you realise how hard it would be to be trying to drag somebody up out of there before you could start to get out yourself, you know. That was the situation.
What was the position of the aircraft at that point? Was it sort of going down?
Yes. It was diving in a terrific dive. And I actually got in, the pilot, of course, quite correct, he left his seat. And he was in this queue trying to get out through the front hatch. But I climbed into his seat and tried to pull the aircraft out of the dive, but I knew immediately that was no good because the stick was just flopping about and obviously lost all control from the stick, and nothing I could possibly do. And I tried to get out through the dinghy escape hatch, so I couldn't get that undone. So I thought, well, this is my lot, this is the end of my life. Then I suddenly remembered that before bailing out, I should have, you heard me talk about these two buttons where you blow up the identification thing or thermostat.
Yes.
I remembered that I should have triggered that off before I started to bail out. So I went back to my position, sat down, pressed these two buttons, and the next thing I knew was a terrific explosion. And I was, well, I don't know what happened really, I was knocked unconscious. And I can remember half becoming conscious and seeing a huge piece of the aircraft flying by me very closely. And then the parachute opening, which sort of jerked me into, back into a bit of consciousness. But how it happened, I think what happened, much more, I can't remember pulling the ripcord at all. And I think what probably happened, that the ripcord got tangled up with the wreckage as the aircraft was blown apart, and the ripcord got pulled by that. So I was extremely lucky, extremely lucky. And knew I wasn't very far off the ground. When we were first attacked, we'd be flying something like 30,000 feet, or 29, perhaps something like that. And I knew the time that I regained consciousness, the parachute opened in this jolt, I was probably no more than 1,000 feet above the ground.
Gosh, you were very low.
Oh, I must have fallen a terrific way.
Yes.
And, was still only half conscious when I was coming down. I remember hitting the ground much harder than I thought I should have been doing. On the way down, that's it, I realised that the parachute harness had been ripped off from one side of my body. The straps had been ripped right off. But I had enough sense, I was conscious enough then to realise that if I leant over to that side, I would fall out completely and be dangling by my feet from the parachute. But I had enough sense and enough consciousness to realise what I've got to do. And I just clung on to the straps as hard as I could. The straps going up to the parachute, and just held on like that.
Wow.
So, I was extremely lucky.
So were you coming down because this was, you know, the target was Berlin, but were you actually over Berlin when you were hit?
Sorry, I didn't hear that bit.
Were you actually over Berlin when you were hit?
No, I think we were about probably 5-8 miles away, I should think. We were just coming up to the target.
Right.
I could see the fires of Berlin, of course, burning, and I knew I mustn't go that way. So when I started to think about evading, I knew I'd got to go in the opposite direction, put those fires in the back of me. But I didn't get very far before they picked me up. They probably saw me coming down, you see.
Yes.
They were looking for me.
Yes, but you were picked up by German soldiers, were you?
German soldiers, yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay, because, I mean, obviously,
yes.
At that time, there was quite a lot of threat to Allied aircrew, wasn't there, from the civilian population?
Yes, oh yes, I was lucky. You know, we were never told anything about the hostility of the civilian population. To them, otherwise it couldn't do any good. Couldn't do any good if it did, but what I read about it afterwards, I was extremely lucky. If I was going to be blown out somewhere near Berlin, the further you're away from it, the better.
Yes.
Because
yes.
If the civilians got hold of you, this is likely to string you up from a lamppost. But being picked up with the military,
yes.
Of course, was a much different tale, maybe. They've got a different attitude.
Good.
In fact, they were quite kind to me and gave me a lot of medical attention. And,
so how badly injured were you?
Well, I could still walk, but both my knees were up like balloons. I must have hit the wreckage with those. They took the brunt of the explosion. And my head was badly gashed, I know that. My shoulders was badly, I don't know what happened to it. I was knocked about, but very, very extremely lucky to get away with what I did.
Yes, you were extremely lucky, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Now, what I'm going to do now is stop the recording
yes.
at this point, which I'm just going to do now.